Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Let's dig right in here. There's a lot to talk about. A lot of things obviously going on in the CRE space. First question, you've obviously both been through economic downturns before, whether it be 01, the dot-com crash, 08 with the Great Recession, and now with COVID in 2020. Aside from the obvious regarding this being caused by a pandemic, how do you think this time will be different and how it may shake out?
I can start, Mitch. First of all, just judging from my hair color, this clearly isn't my first slowdown. Look, this is a bit different from 08. You know, 2008 focused more on the banks who were insolvent at the time. This time around, the pandemic is impacting just about every type of industry. We're seeing tremendous layoffs and furloughs, and unemployment claims are much higher than they were in 2008. I think this pandemic will affect the way people run their everyday lives. Simple tasks such as going to a restaurant, watching a ball game, traveling, things like that will have to change. I think there's a fear that this crisis won't go away anytime soon, and I think this will affect many different industries, obviously including real estate.
So just jumping on the back of that, Andy, which I concur with what you're saying, I think for at least a period of time, travel will be impacted, right? Shopping, other consumer tasks. Do you think that this will be something that has a longer term impact, far longer than, say, the travel slowdown post 9/11? Or do you actually think there's a fundamental change in the way people may travel or shop or pick your topic you want to kind of highlight?
Look, I don't think anybody really knows. I don't think anybody really has a crystal ball to figure out exactly how we're going to get impacted. But look, you know, I think the way we sit at a restaurant is going to be different. I think that, you know, there's going to have to be tables in between us. So I don't think that the restaurants are going to have as many revenues as they have today. I think that they're talking about sports right now, about having spectatorless ball games. So that could go on in the unforeseen future. So I think it's really just unknown at this point.
Yeah. And then certainly the impacts on commercial real estate, whether it be as an equity investor or as a lender like we are, is still to be determined and be played out. Brian, let me move over to you for a quick second. Looking forward, you know, where do you see the most opportunities in commercial real estate lending, which you focus on? And what is the obvious thing that you would avoid knowing what you know now, obviously not being able to predict the future?
Well, I think there's going to be opportunities in every sector, Mitch. I really do. I just think that there are certain sectors that are definitely harder hit. I think the hotel industry, and this is not rocket scientists, I mean, the hotels are shut down, basically. And I think that's how long that takes to recover is just unknown at this point. I mean, I think there's going to be the point where everyone's deemed it safe. And then I think there's going to be the mental aspect too. When are people actually going to travel and stay at a hotel? Are they going to be more comfortable at an Airbnb versus a hotel? Do they want to stay at a new hotel versus an old hotel? I think there's going to be that lagging effect caused by this pandemic. For us, we lend on hotels. So fortunately, it's not a big part of our portfolio, but you know, a lot of them that are under construction are getting modified right now. That's actually a good thing because you don't want to be open right now. We do a lot of senior living. I think senior living, you know, it's not as big a sector as apartments and hotels and all those other types of properties, but I think it's big enough and it affects us in a different way. I think there's an emotional tie to the senior living space. And I think that's going to be tough. It's going to be different than the hotels, but it's tougher to recover on the senior living side because it seems like when the virus gets into one of those nursing home or assisted living, it just wipes out the whole facility. and it ruins the reputation. So that too will take time to get back and get better. But I think for us as a lender across all the types of properties, there will be great opportunities for us on the hotel side and on the senior living side. Generally right now, we're switching to more looking at assets that have cash flow. The ones that have cash flow going in are better suited if they get hit versus ones that are trying to grow the cash flow. And I think that's what we're looking at, more straight down the fairway type properties with cash flow that looks like it's going to continue to be coming in every month, month after month. But like Andy said, we really don't know long-term what's going to happen. And I think there's no finish line in sight. No one really has an idea. Yeah, we're opening up states and we're opening up this, that, and the other, but there's the fear, you know, are we opening up too soon? Even if we can't open up and we're allowed to, are we going to open up? Some of these businesses may not even need to open up. And I think when you look at stuff like retail, the bigger issue is, okay, restaurants closed. They're closed for 60, 90, 120 days. Landlords are giving them concessions, but do they have the capital to even reopen? And do they want to reopen? Some of these mom and pop restaurants don't even want to get back and open up because it's going to cost them money to do so. And it's aggravation and uncertainty. So I think it's nothing safe, but I think the hotel and the senior living spaces are the ones most affected. And I think retail will get into that a little more down the road, but that's definitely a sector that had its problems before this started. And I don't think this helps it at all.
Andy mentioned maybe restaurants, an example, having more space in between tables. I've even heard scenarios of airlines actually keeping the middle seats unsold, right, to keep more distance. When you think about the revenue models, and let's take obviously a restaurant as an example, rent is a huge component of their operating expenses. If you have the number of available seats cut by third, let's say, right, thinking about the trickle-down effect to the rents, I think it's going to be a pretty drastic evaluation for owners to say, okay, to even actually be able to rent the space out, I have to kind of reset my expectations from, let's say, $50 a foot to maybe $25 a foot. That's going to be, I think, a long time to hit the psyche of these owners who are so used to seeing robust demand for their spaces and having a tenant right on the back of one going out historically, at least in high street, you know, Manhattan, LA, Chicago, DC, Miami type places.
And it's a cost associated with that, Mitch. They're changing uses, let's say, like Andy talked about in restaurants. If someone walks into the restaurant, you're greeted by somebody with a mask. They're going to have a thermometer and they're going to pass you a disposable menu that you throw away. And then your waiter or waitress is going to come over and help you with a mask on. So it takes away all that personal, why go out? Why go to a restaurant?
You know, one thing I want to touch on real quick, I know you have two buckets of capital that you lend out of. You know, one is the traditional REIT, but you also have an opportunistic bucket that you guys have raised. Talk to us about rescue capital and how you may see that play out.
You can go, Andy. Go ahead and answer.
Rescue capital is, you know, being in the loan business, you get to see a lot of loans. And depending on the type of loan, you might need it more of a traditional loan, or the borrower may not have enough equity going in. So we could prefer it, provide a slice of preferred equity or mezz debt in order to capitalize the property that the borrower might have trouble getting at. We think that there's a tremendous opportunity right now. Capital is a little bit more scarce than it was 6 weeks ago, where capital was more free-flowing, and it creates an opportunity for you to get higher returns and maybe get a slice of the equity in a property, as well as just being a traditional lender, which we've done historically. So we think it's a great opportunity and a great bucket to have some capital in right now that we're focused on.
I would concur with that. I think that I would say it's not just a little scarce, it's very scarce. I think if you're looking for capital now, you're either trying to close a purchase or you have to refi. Otherwise, you're probably trying to work with your existing lender, which leads us to our next topic, I guess, here. How do you guys approach a loan that has issues? I know that there's a lot of talk of forbearances in the marketplace and modifications, some type of, I wouldn't call it a partnership, if you will, but an understanding between a lender and a borrower right now, that given the times are very unique, that you have to kind of maybe play with kid gloves to kind of facilitate an ultimate repayment of that loan. Can you tell us about how you think about, you know, a mod versus a foreclosure versus forbearance and how you approach that?
Sure. Look, I think it's really deal specific and it really depends on the circumstances. If we feel that the borrower is sort of abusing the situation or is asking something that they really don't need, we're not going to be that kind to the borrower. But honestly, if there's legitimate issues and the borrower is being very communicative and proactive, we're going to assist in some sort of forbearance or loan mod that will allow that borrower to stay in the asset for an extended period of time till hopefully the economy will recover. Look, I would say that We've been very fortunate in our business because we don't have any leverage in our portfolio right now. And therefore, our portfolio is, we're really allowing our portfolio to perform, and it's continuing to perform. And because of that, we can still operate and lend money in situations. We're going to be very selective in this market, but we still finding some opportunities. So, but look, it really is borrower dependent. If the borrower really needs the capital and they've been a good borrower, we're going to do everything we can to try to help them out.
And, you know, just to touch on for our users who are on this webinar to understand exactly what you refer to with leverage, you know, some lenders borrow against their loans, right? So they have a senior or other participant in their investments that they have to keep current in the event of non-payment. So that places additional pressure on, in the case of this, it'd be by iBorrow or someone else, where they're maybe forced to come out of pocket. Having no leverage in your fund gives you tons of flexibility to do as you see fit and not have to go to another participant to get approval for a modification or any other type of restructuring that you would pursue. And I think if you've been reading the journal or any other paper with mortgage REITs, as an example, they've been in severe distress for mark-to-market calls on repo facilities for their loans. So that's obviously a huge advantage that you guys have in the market we're in today. So that's a great fact pattern. You mentioned retail earlier, Brian. You know, it's a topic that we get often asked a lot. We've done very little on the retail side on the platform in Yield Street for a very specific reason. I've been pretty negative on it for quite some time. You know, malls for many, many years I've been down on. But even now, high street retail and the repositioning of where those rents were 5-6 years ago and where they are now. Do you think retail is, dying is a kind of an overused term, but do you really think there's a future in the retail sector of attractiveness for an owner of real estate? And do you think it's just simply changing and it's going to continue to be evolving over time?
It's a great question. I mean, honestly, you know, Amazon wins, right? I mean, we all kind of conceded that their model, it worked before and it's working better now. That's part of the reason I'm in the office instead of home, is because our doorbell keeps ringing with new Amazon packages every hour, it seems like. But you can still have a successful shopping center. I think drug and market anchored centers are surviving if the structure's right in terms of the physical structure and in terms of the location. I think certain cities are over retail and they're built out and you have shopping centers after shopping centers after shopping center, mid-block, corner, and everywhere in between. So I do think it should be a part of the real estate portfolios to have a small amount of retail, but you better make sure that it's built the right way, the structure is appropriate, your tenant base is appropriate, and that, you know, people want to go there. It's a destination. So I think, you know, I was listening to a few people talk about retail last week. It's definitely forcing the hand of the retailers to come up with new and innovative ideas to get people to their stores. And if they don't innovate, they die. Right. And if you're somebody that was sort of a trendier concept, once the trend ends, you're dead. And you spend all this money building out the space and then that's lost. So I think that's a big problem. I do think eventually the restaurants will figure a way to make this work and people will want to get out. But these indoor malls that were around, you know, we had 1,200 large indoor shopping centers, malls around the country, 800 are basically done. And there's 400 left. And a few own those 400 and a lot of them are still struggling. And I see that they're opening, I think it was Simon Property Group's opening a bunch of their—
Yeah, 49
of them. Yeah. And, you know, it'll be interesting. Okay, you're opening them. That's great. But is anybody going to show up? Is anybody going to walk around? And if they do show up and walk around, are they going to buy anything? Because that's really the ticket. If they're not buying anything, you know, then what's the point? And so it's, you kind of got to watch it. We're obviously very conservative on retail. I grew up kind of in retail and we get a lot of retail deals and you just have to be very, very selective.
You know, Brian, I know you're very experienced at your prior presidential role at Eagle. You know, you were very involved in shopping centers. You know, you think about a traditional shopping center, neighborhood center, you have a grocery anchor, you have a nail salon, maybe a mailboxes or UPS type store. That to me is not changing. The question is, do you need 50 different types of apparel sellers for men's and women's clothing? That's to me the biggest part of the market that's oversaturated, and that you have way too many companies that probably shouldn't be in existence and you don't need to exist. And you think about guys who are now digital direct only, like Tommy John, Bombas for socks, you know, American Giant for sweatpants and stuff like that. Those guys are killing it and actually are opening locations. Warby Parker is another example, right? They're picking some stores open as well. Do you think that that trend will evolve and continue and be maybe the next generation of stores to open up?
Maybe. I mean, Warby Parker is a perfect example. I mean, eyeglasses you got to try on, right? I mean, you got to
look.
Andy Peltz did not order those glasses online. He went and tried them out, made sure they look spectacular like they do. I mean, that you've got to do that. I mean, jeans, I don't know. You can buy jeans and you can order three different sizes and they'll send them all to you. And then you ship back the ones that don't fit. It's evolving. I think it's early to tell, but I think drugstores, markets, those are working. Those dumbbell centers, those have always been working. It's just what's in between. What else are you going to do? And if you've got a 5 to 10,000 foot space, what are you really putting into that? Look at the malls now. I mean, you know how many big box deals we get where they're converting it to storage, self-storage, or church? I mean, how many self-storage and churches do you need around the country? I think there's a limit to that. And so when I talked about structure, physical structure, that's what's really important. Is it a usable space? Is it small enough that you can fit it and put somebody in there that's of use?
Got it. Okay. Let's move on. I think retail is a topic that will continue to be something that is continuing to be brought up and, you know, a focus. You think about, an example, in New York area, there's a 3 million square foot mall called American Dream that was scheduled to open, you know, a month ago. It's the Gramazian family. They also created Mall of America in Minneapolis. And 55% of that square footage is actually dedicated to experiential real estate. There's a ski lift, right? There's a indoor water park. There's a indoor amusement park. It's Nickelodeon themed. I mean, they're really trying to target families who are people who want an experience rather than just a shopping destination. Time will tell whether that's successful or not, but that is kind of where I think new generation retail is going. And last thing I would add personally, when you think about shopping, I mean, there's a lot of friction within that. You have to find a parking spot. You got to get out. You got to find the spot you want to go to. You got to wait online for, because only two checkout counters are open. I mean, it's a pain. It's a real pain. Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned like ordering three jeans online, having it sent to your house. That's a pleasure, mm-hmm. you know, other than maybe getting returning it, which are also trying to, you know, make that easier now.
Right.
But that's something I concur with you completely. I agree with that.
It's interesting, Mitch, just to add on to that. You know, I see some of the questions popping up, and Amazon is that hybrid model too now. I mean, they have retail brick and mortar that are interesting. You walk in, you just happen to be there. Maybe it's easier to buy it then versus online. I don't know the answer, but they're working. Whatever they're doing is working. Maybe it is a hybrid model. Maybe it's not right. One or the other. It's both.
Well, they're certainly trying a lot of different structures. So there is actually an Amazon Go in our office in the city where you essentially scan your phone. And there are cameras that track you. You pick out any item you want off the shelf and you walk out. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned the friction, right? There's no friction there. It's a pleasure to shop there. But inventory is limited, right? It's more of like a mini like 7-Eleven type structure than it is anything else but that. Mm-hmm. But you're right. I mean, the bookstores have opened up as well. They've kind of taken over some of Barnes & Noble old haunting grounds and been successful with it. So, but they don't also break that out. That's not a huge component of their business. Whole Foods certainly was a big acquisition for them and a drive to get into more of the shopping business, right? The food service business or the grocery business, which they've really actually made better in many ways, right? With their Prime, Amazon Prime, you can scan it, save money. They've developed that loyalty that I don't think other grocers have done before as well as they have, right? So that's like another advantage of having that. We didn't talk about industrial that much. And I know you guys also are involved in industrial as an asset class and a property type. Why don't you talk a little bit about how you're thinking about that space? Is it more logistical, final mile type setup, or you do more manufacturing? And do you see that as something that you're going to target looking forward?
Brian, do you want me to start? Or?
Go ahead.
Look, we like industrial a lot. Obviously, it depends on the tenant that you have, but we think industrial is here to stay. And we think that if anything, this pandemic highlights the need for more industrial. We think that the government's speaking about the fact that we're going to have to bring manufacturing really back into this country again. And we think industrial is a great asset class when it comes to that. So we think it's an extremely interesting area, and it's something that we love to lend on good quality industrials. Even if the tenants aren't perfect, if it's the right asset in the right location, we think that the value is going to remain.
Yeah, I think we agree with that. Certainly it's something that we've had a hard time actually winning loans against because of the demand from the borrower strength, the leverage that the borrowers had. It was a very in-demand property type to lend against. It was deemed as stable, secure, and a growing asset class. So that was a harder thing to get involved with. I want to touch on a couple of quick questions. We had a bunch of different ones. I saw Brian mention the Amazon answer, so let's assume that one is done. Student housing is something we didn't talk about. You know, I saw yesterday Harvard's actually considering opening up the fall semester with no students on campus. How do you think about student housing? You know, it's been a darling for many years. Now it's, I think, been viewed as overbuilt. Do you have any thoughts on that? Have you bent against it? And would you look at it now?
Yeah, sure. I'll comment on that. I think student housing, it's definitely a niche within multifamily. And I think it has its own idiosyncrasies that are really going to be challenged right now. I mean, you have to have a successful year or 12 months in a row at a student housing facility, you have to have it pre-leased. I think the pre-leasing is questionable right now when fall semester is in question. And I'll give you an example. My daughter's hopefully going to college in the fall. She's waiting. But the question is anyone opening up in the fall? And if one big college like Harvard or a Michigan or somebody says, we're not opening in the fall, it's all going to be done distance learning and everybody can go to Michigan by being in LA, then what happens to all those apartments? Not only, forget about the ones that are owned by the college, but all the other student housing investments that are made in that area, they're going to be empty. And then also all the other stuff that's not technically student housing, but it's where the vendors live, the service providers live, the teachers live, those are going to be empty also. So that has this amazing effect, a negative effect on a college town that's reliant on people. And I think that's what's going to happen. And I think there's going to be a major ripple effect in student housing. We're already seeing it. A lot of lenders are pulling out. We are looking at it closely. We've gotten a few deals that we got down to the finish line and then couldn't understand what they were thinking. And they've already when we dug deeper, they had a lot of signed leases where the tenants were, or residents were asking for their deposit back. So they weren't just going to show up in the fall.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's a tough little niche and long-term great, you know, good college. Eventually this will get back to normal, but for the next 12 months, 18 months, and with the cycle that student housing goes into in order, the pre-leasing cycle to get it leased up for the fall, it's tough. It's really a tougher investment.
I think any loan, student housing, hospitality, retail, you're going to be baking in larger reserves up front to kind of bridge a borrower to that hopefully open of the economy. Let's take one or two more quick questions and I want to give you guys some closing thoughts. This is a topic that I've actually thought about is, does the COVID pandemic accelerate a flight out of the cities because of the density and concerns? You know, the millennial workforce has been wanting to live, play, and eat near their space of employment. I'm assuming if you're in the city now in a studio apartment and you're stuck, it's quite nerve-wracking and, you know, a problem. Does that lead to people trying to get out sooner or even now? And I don't have the answer to that. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that topic.
Yeah, I would start by saying, look, I think New York, for example, is obviously a very unique market right now where the pandemic really had an impact on the city. A lot of my friends back east are renting homes right now in places like Florida, and they're actually even considering staying there for the school year because they don't want their kids in the city right now being in school next year. So they think they would maybe rather move to a house, move out of the city. So I think there might be a flight to places like Florida. Another thing is when you're in a recession and you're in a high tax jurisdiction like a New York or a Los Angeles where I live right now, a lot of people are thinking about moving to other places to low tax or no state tax jurisdictions, which are very appealing right now. So I do think that there are going to be a flight out of some cities, particularly the more expensive cities, and a recession like this might drive that a little bit.
I could see that. I think that's actually an accurate portrayal, Andy. I could see people who may have wanted to delay that move if they're a family or young family and they need more space and want to kind of get to a school district or start the commuting time later. Maybe this pushes them out. I have some friends now looking out of the city for that very reason. So I think that's a very appropriate analysis. Do you guys want to give some parting thoughts before we conclude here?
Sure. I'm seeing all these questions. Hopefully we can get to them later.
Yeah, I think I'll take one more, but why don't you get some parting thoughts? We'll come back to that one.
Sure. So I think having the experience of lived through a couple of these downturns, 08 specifically, 01, I do see some parallels. I think the key is if you're on the investment side or you're an investor in real estate, I think the key here is the people that have reserves and have not tried to hit home runs are going to win out. And I think it just, every time this happens, it seems like it just sort of somebody trying to beat it into everybody, which is try to hit singles, try to hit doubles maybe. But when you go for home runs and you get caught in this, in a downturn, it's very, very hard to last. And people with leverage, whether it's over leveraged and they bought something that's over leveraged and now the value's gone down, or lenders who had leverage lines, repo lines within their lending capabilities, those are gone. And I think it just shows you that leverage works in a market where it's going up and it really hurts in a market going down. And I think the other side of this is be patient. I think these values are going to come back. This is something completely different than 08 in that you really couldn't see it coming. It wasn't a bank-induced kind of problem. It was something we've never been through before anywhere, any of us that are alive. And it will get better. And just the question is when. And I think if everybody's patient, I think it'll come back hopefully sooner rather than later, and it won't come back again. So I think it's a little depressing, but I think we all see the light at the end of the tunnel a little bit right now. So I'm hopeful. And as an asset class, for sure, real estate will survive.
With that, I want to say thank you again to Brian and Andy for joining us today on this webinar. Really appreciate your insights and your time, as well as your partnership. We've had some great success with you guys on the platform and hope to continue doing that in the future. So thank you, everyone. Thank you, listeners and folks who joined us today. And look out for the next webinar coming up. Take care.
Thanks, Mitch. Thank you, guys.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7-10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.